to be that son. And in one sense, the temple that we read about being built at the beginning of 1 Kings, that's going to be the partial fulfillment of what's said here. Verse 14, I will be his father, and he shall be my son. This is what the Lord is saying. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul. In other words, I'm not going to strip the kingdom from him completely if he becomes disobedient, but he's going to be chastened. He's going to be disciplined. In verse 16, your house, your kingdom shall be established forever. Before you, your throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Okay? So that promise runs all through the kings. God's going to place one on the throne that eventually will lead to the coming of the Messiah. House, not just a temple, but a spiritual body. So we come to 1 Kings, and remember, David is an old man. It looks like Adonijah is a threat to the throne. Solomon was the one declared by God to be the successor of David. And so we see all the political intrigue as men made decisions, and God used those decisions to place Solomon on the throne. So as we come to the end of chapter 1, Adonijah, his plot is thwarted, and Solomon comes to be king, co-regent with David, at least initially. So that kind of brings us back to where we are. And what we've seen so far is we've been introduced to Adonijah, who was an opportunist. He tried to take advantage of a fragile situation and usurp the throne. We've seen Nathan and some others as loyalists. They were loyal to David despite what was going on, Adonijah's desires. And then we saw David as a realist. He understood what was happening. So he, in his old age, gets up off his bed, announces that Solomon's going to be king, and puts things in position and place for that house, the physical side of it, the temple to be built. That brings us up to 1 Kings chapter 2. And we actually haven't got this far, but here's where we see David as the realist. And once he anoints Solomon as king, he prepares him for what's coming and he delivers a speech to him. So back to 1 Kings chapter 2. Here's what the text says. Verses 1 to 4. What's the gist of David's message to his son? Verses 1 to 4, he says, you need to put the Lord first as king. Old Testament, the Pentateuch, Deuteronomy, the laws of Deuteronomy as they were reaffirmed by Moses in that book, the keeping of them or the breaking of them are spotlighted throughout the kings. And the idea is if a king would be loyal to God's covenant and obey his laws, then everything would be fine. The people would be blessed in every sense of the way. But if he disobeyed those laws and the people disobeyed them, then curses would follow. So what David does initially is he says, you need to keep the kingdom of God first in your heart and mind. Verse 1 says, now the days of David drew near that he should die. He charged Solomon, his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. That the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. You know, when you read your Pentateuch, first five books of the law of Moses, when you see all of those laws and all of those commandments, understand that would be both the religious and political a lifeline of the Israelites. If they were faithful, both whether we're talking individually or nationally to those laws, they could expect blessing. They could expect blessing. And physical blessing, for that matter, as a nation. But should they disobey? Deuteronomy 28, you'll be cursed in your going out, and you'll be cursed in your coming. So this is the reminder, Solomon, you need to remain faithful to the one true God. Never turn your back on him. As long as you do that, As long as your sons do that, the kingdom will prosper, and I'll be with you. So that's the first part of this speech that David gives in the first four verses. Put the Lord first. And we'll see this reminder again and again of what kings need to do and the nation needs to do, just like this. Now, we come to verses 5 to 9. It's also seen in 13 through 46. David urges Solomon to protect the kingdom. Who's already been an enemy of God's plan in Solomon's reign? Who's our guy? Adonijah. You can just call him Addy if you want, if you can't remember. Adonijah has been a threat. Abiathar the priest joined hands with him. Joab, David's commander, joined hands with him. So there have been threats to his kingdom. So, with that in mind, we see David's call for protection. Look at verse 5. He says, "Moreover, you know also what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the army of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner, and Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed, and he shed the blood of war in peacetime, and put the blood of war in his belt that was around his waist, and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore do according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace." Now, if you don't know the Old Testament, if you're not familiar with 1 and 2 Samuel, this probably doesn't mean much to you. What you need to remember was David was Joab's commander, and on two separate occasions, in cold blood, Joab killed certain military leaders of Israel who were seeking to be either at peace with David or had done nothing worthy of death. Joab saw them as foes, even though particularly in one case, David saw them as now allies. Joab slew them. He murdered them very heinously. And David was extremely upset about that. But here's something else, and I don't know again where you are in your study of the Old Testament, how much you remember, no. But there was one thing that Joab did that really didn't sit well with David. Worse than the death of Amasa, worse than the death of Abner. Anybody remember what Joab's role was in Absalom's death? Absalom was David's son. Remember, Absalom usurped the throne. "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, oh, Absalom." David just was brokenhearted when Absalom did that and then paid the price fully for his misdeeds. He was put to death. Who called for his execution? Joab did. You know what David told Joab and his military men when they went out to find Absalom? "Do not harm the lad. Stop him, but don't you hurt my son." Now, from a military standpoint, Absalom was deserving of death, because he had proven himself to be an enemy of David's kingdom. And in any other setting, it would have been the natural thing to do, execute him. But David, as most parents would, no matter how far afield a son or daughter may go, he said, "Do the lad no harm." But when Absalom became vulnerable, Joab said, "You run him through with the sword. You kill him." And they did. And David, you can imagine how that must have sat with him. So he says, "You take care of Joab, my old military commander who's gone on board with Adonijah." And I'm paraphrasing and explaining. He says, he's a threat. He's a threat to the security of your throne. Chapter 1, succession to the throne. Chapter 2, security regarding the throne. You take care of Joab. Verse 7, "But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite." I don't know why every time I see Barzillai the Gileadite, the word Godzilla runs through my head. "And let them be among those who eat at your table, for so they came to me when I fled from Absalom your brother." Now, Barzillai was an old man who aided David during this period of time, and David tried to take him to Jerusalem so that he could just basically be pampered the rest of his life. Barzillai said, "No, I'm an old man. I'd rather stay in my own town, but take my son. Take him and honor him for my kindness towards you." So David said, "You remember that, Solomon? He's an ally. But there's some other threats." Verse 8, And see, you have with you Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite from Bahurim, who who cursed me with a malicious curse in the day when I went to Mahanaim. Does anybody know the tribe Solomon was from? He was of the tribe, not Solomon, pardon me, Saul. He was a Benjamite. Notice this fellow who cursed David is a Benjamite. He was of Saul's house. He was loyal to Saul. So when David had difficulties, even with his own son, when David was fleeing Jerusalem because of danger, Shimei comes out and throws rocks at him and curses him. And some of David's military men said, "Let me go over and take his head off." And David said, "No, no, I feel like this is what I have coming to me. Don't do him any harm." But evidently he's a threat still. And so David reminds Solomon of this, and he says, "But he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword." When David retook the throne, Shimei was the first one to meet him and to fall down before him and beg forgiveness, and David given it. So David remembered that too. But again, he sees him as a threat. Evidently, his repentance not being sincere. And so in verse 9, he says, "Now therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man and know what you ought to do to him, but bring his gray hair down to the grave with blood." Now this may sound, and there may be something to it, it may sound like this is all personal vengeance. But in another sense, to have served as a traitor against David, who was God's anointed one, God's man, was really a slight against God himself. And against God's plan for his kingdom. And so it may sound like this is personal vengeance. Maybe there is a grudge there. I don't know. I'd like to think there's not. There's more to it than just what we might think of regarding personal relationships. Somebody slights somebody, and the person slighted says, when the opportunity arises, you go get him back for that. I don't think that's exactly what's in mind here. There's more to it. There's a spiritual side. There's an affront that's been there's been an affront against God. And so I think some of that comes into play. So you have in verses 5 through 9, you have David urging the kingdom to be protected. All right? And we'll see more in 13 through 46. Secure your kingdom, Solomon. Take care of these threats in the way that you seem best. Then verses 10 through 12, we read of the passing of David. This great man of God goes to rest with his fathers. He's buried in Jerusalem or the city of David. The text tells us he reigned over Israel 40 years, 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. In verse 12, here's where the transition takes place. Then Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom was firmly established. That was God's will. Okay? Solomon, your son, will sit on your throne. Solomon, your son, will build you a house. There were threats, there were dangers, but now he has been firmly established. God's will comes to fruition in Solomon arising as king. He's no longer co-regent as he was before. He and David both serving in that capacity. He's serving all alone. Now, David's a realist, and he says to Solomon, "You take care of the threats." And so Solomon becomes the strategist. He's going to map out a strategy as to how to take care of these difficult individuals. These folks who evidently still serve as a threat. Now here's an interesting thing. David's house represents a dynasty. You know what a dynasty is? A dynasty is a line of sons or offspring that continually over time reign on the throne. Dad sits on the throne, he gets old, he passes it on to his son. He dies, son reigns for a time, he gets old, he passes it on to his son, all the way down the line. And so when one king would come and usurp another king, what would he do to all the heirs of the throne? He would kill them all. Why? Because as long as there were those who could say through some physical means, some physical lineage, they had ties to the throne, as long as there was somebody who could walk around saying, "That's rightly my position," they were a threat. Now, there may have been times when there were some who didn't care about that, but just simply because you were of the line of the previous king, you were done. Okay? As we saw at the end of chapter 1, Solomon showed mercy to Adonijah. Adonijah would have killed him to eradicate any threat so that the line would have gone through him and his descendants and not Solomon. Solomon showing mercy and grace, that's fine. But don't think he's not viewing Adonijah through that lens of he's still a danger. I've got to keep my eye on. So here's what we have. We have the order of elimination here in chapter 2. The order of elimination. 13 through 25, Adonijah is going to show himself to be underhanded. And he's going to then be punished for it. Abiathar, who had joined forces with him, one time David's loyal high priest who took care of David's tent in Jerusalem that housed the ark, he's going to pay for what he's done. Joab, who had done so much against David and violated the principles that David upheld, even though he was loyal to David often during David's reign, he's going to pay the price. And then this fellow Shimei, who had cursed David but had shown some repentance and David allowed him to live, Solomon's going to deal with him too. We're securing this kingdom that God had in mind. Could God have secured it another way? Yes. Could God have secured it directly? Could he have just seen to it that all these folks were struck dead like Ananias and Sapphira? He could have. But God typically works and moves through human agency. And so he's going to use Solomon and Benaiah, his military leader now, to take care of these guys, to secure this kingdom, that this house might be built, that there might be a line from David's family that eventually would lead to the Christ who would sit on the throne and reign forever and ever. We can't forget that. All of this history is not just for the purpose of history. It's God working and moving to see to it that these promises that he made will come to fruition. And he is the great organizer and orchestrator and use the free moral agency of men to bring about his overall will. It's a thing of beauty when you look at it. All right, so Adonijah, Solomon's brother, brother of Absalom, that good-looking guy, that suave and debonair dude who for just a short time seemed to fascinate the people and have them on his side, he's not to be trusted. So in verse 13, it says, "Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said, 'Do you come peaceably?'" That's interesting because earlier Nathan had come to Bathsheba and he said, "You go to David and tell him what's going on." She was the intermediary between Nathan and David earlier. But he's loyal to David. Nathan's a friend. Now an enemy comes and he's also trying to use Bathsheba to get now to Solomon, who's the king. It's an interesting kind of a thing that there are these patterns that we see in the Kings. Why does she say, "Have you come peaceably?" She's Solomon's mother, right? Adonijah shows up. He had tried to usurp the throne. He begged for mercy. Solomon gave it to her, or to him. Now she comes to him, or he comes to her, and she says, "Do you come peaceably?" What's she worried about? He's a threat. He's not to be trusted. "Oh, yes, my son showed him mercy and grace, but he's a threat. Do you come peaceably?" Peaceably, verse 14. "Moreover, he said, 'I have something to say to you.'" And she said, "Say it." Remember, she evidently had influence with David. She has influence with Solomon too. 15. "Then he said, 'You know that the kingdom was mine, and all Israel had set their expectations on me that I should reign.'" What does that seem to imply regarding his attitude? You know, I had this in the palm of my hand. You know, I was really close, right? Even though he knew full well, evidently by the next statement, that it wasn't God's will for him to sit on that throne, he said, "You know, I was really close. However, the kingdom has been turned over and has become my brother's, for it was from the Lord. Now I ask one petition of you, do not deny me." And she said to him, "Say it." Then he said, "Please speak to King Solomon, for he will not refuse you, that he may give me Abishag the Shulamite, his wife." Who's Abishag the Shulamite? That's David's professional snuggler, right? That's the gal that was chosen for him as a concubine to keep him warm in his old age when his virility and his circulation had begun to run short. Now, why is this a big deal? Now, let's see if we can figure it out. Now, Bathsheba may be thinking, Adonijah's a threat. He's a threat to me and he's a threat to my son. So maybe I ought to acquiesce and make this request known to keep the peace. I'm just speculating now. I don't know why she goes along with it, but it makes sense to me that that may very well be what's going on. Or she just doesn't seem to understand the intent. But she seems to be a very sharp woman in a lot of ways. She doesn't seem to be a dummy based on Nathan's use of her and her part played in all of that and now this. But who knows? Verse 19, Bathsheba therefore went to the king, to King Solomon, to speak to him for Adonijah. And the king rose up to meet her and bowed down to her and sat down on his throne and had a throne set for his king's mother. So she sat at his right hand. That's a good boy right there, isn't it? He takes care of mom. His mom is his queen, has a throne for her, again showing her influence. Then she said, I desire one small petition for you. Do not refuse me. King said to her, ask it, my mother, for I will not refuse you. So she said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as wife. And King Solomon answered and said to his mother, now why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? And he gets it. He sees something underhanded here regarding Adonijah's desire to take the throne. He says, ask for him the kingdom also. For he is my older brother, for him and for Abiathar the priest and for Joab the son of Zeruiah. And as David swore an oath after Bathsheba talked or spoke in chapter 1, we see the pattern. Solomon does the same. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord saying, may God do so to me and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has confirmed me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has established a house for me as he promised Adonijah shall be put to death today. So King Solomon sent by the hand of Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down and he died. All he asked for was for one concubine. Now when a king took possession of the throne, even whether it be through lineage or usurping the throne, overthrowing another dynasty, whatever the previous king owned was his. Whatever described the king as ruler possession-wise, those possessions became his. It was a sign that the kingdom had been turned over to now the successor. And so when Adonijah says, give me Abishag, in essence he's saying, I'm subtly making it known that I still believe this kingdom is mine. Why did he do that? I don't know. What was his plan after this? And there also seems to be some implication that Joab and Abiathar are also in on this plot. They're not done yet. Remember what Absalom did regarding David's concubines after he usurped the throne and David fled from Jerusalem? Anybody remember that? He put up a tent in the sight of everybody, housed those concubines, and went in and slept with them all. Why did he do that? Say he's just a sorry man. No. It was a sign saying the kingdom is now mine and what was my father's belongs to me. So when Adonijah said, give me Abishag, there's something very subtle there. He in essence is making a play for the kingdom of David. Solomon, pardon me, sniffs it out. Adonijah died. Beginning in verse 26 and going through verse 27, Abiathar, the one-time high priest. Remember, during David's reign, there were two priests who basically functioned as high priests. It's kind of an odd arrangement. But you had Abiathar, who was David's priest in Jerusalem, who took care of the ark, which was housed in a tent there. There was priestly service around that tent because the ark was there. The tabernacle was in Gibeon, a high place, and there the furnishings were, but the ark wasn't there. And there Zadok plied his trade and took care of that, oversaw it, along with other priests who ministered around that tabernacle. So you had basically two high priests. But Abiathar went to Adonijah's side. So, verse 26 says, and Abiathar the priest, the king, said, go to Anatoth. That's where Jeremiah was. It was a city of retirement place for priests and where priests lived. To your own fields, for you are deserving of death, but I will not put you to death at this time, because you carried the ark of the Lord before my father David, and because you were afflicted every time my father was afflicted. Verse 27 is the fulfillment of prophecy. We don't have time to look at it all, but back in 1 Samuel, there was a high priest by the name of Eli. He had two sons named Hophni and Phinehas, which again, twin boys, great names, Hophni and Phinehas. And they served as priests at the tabernacle, which was, I'm trying to think, it might have been in Gibeah at that time. And they were immoral and corrupt. His sons did all kinds of heinous actions. In fact, the women who would come to worship, they were having relations with them right there at the tabernacle. And they were taking advantage of the worshipers, and they were threatening them if they didn't receive more than they were supposed to receive as priests. And a man of God came to Eli, who should have been monitoring that situation. He said, this is what the Lord says. You honor your sons more than you honor me. You love your family more than you love me. You allow this to go on, and it's causing the worshipers to despise the worship of God. And he said, was that Shiloh, right? He said, this is what I'm going to do then. I'm going to cut off your house from the priesthood. Eli, you're going to have sons, but eventually they will no longer serve in this capacity. There won't be any more descendants through you ministering around the tabernacle. And then finally, in the days of Abiathar, this prophecy comes to pass when Solomon says, you go to Anatoth, you have been let go. None of your descendants anymore. So Abiathar is let go. Verse 36, we'll just drop down to that. I'm sorry. Verse 28. We need to look at this. 28 through 35 now. Adonijah struck down and dead. Abiathar has been relieved of his duties and sent to retirement. Joab, David's military commander, he's next on the list. So in verse 28, it says, then news came to Joab, for Joab had defected to Adonijah. What news? Uh-oh. Solomon's cleaning house. So he had not defected Absalom, so Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord, took hold of the horns of the altar, and King Solomon was told, Joab has fled to the tabernacle of the Lord, and there he is by the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go strike him down. Now, if we were to go through this, what happens is, Benaiah comes back to David and says, he's got hold of the horns of the altar. And David said, well, just go in there and kill him then. He goes in there and strikes him down. Joab's taken out. Drop down to verse 36 now. Then the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, this is the Benjamite who cursed David earlier. And he said, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and do not go from there anywhere, for it shall be on the day that you go out and cross the brook Kidron, know for certain you shall surely die, your blood shall be on your own head. What does he do here? It's house arrest. Again, mercy's being shown. You stay in the city, you'll be all right. But two of Shimei's servants run away. He saddles his donkey. He leaves the city. He goes and finds them. David hears about it. Shimei is brought before him. Look at verse 46. The king said, moreover, to Shimei, you know, as your heart acknowledges, all the wickedness that you did to my father David. Therefore, the Lord will return your wickedness on your own head. The king Solomon shall be blessed. The throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. Thus the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. All of his threats are now removed. What's the first couple of chapters of 1 Kings about? It's a time of transition between David and Solomon. There are dangers, there are threats. But God providentially bring Solomon to the throne, all the while using the decisions that were made by everyone involved. By the time we come to chapter 2, the promise that God had given to David. Solomon will build you a house. He's in position to build it. Any questions or comments? You're thinking that was the most uninteresting mess I've ever heard in my life. Now, starting next time, Lord willing, the pace will begin to pick up, because these first couple chapters are so important to get Solomon on the throne. We've got to get him there. Or we've got to acknowledge that God got him there. And he got him there. So, remember, some of this will be on the final, so overlook those handouts very closely, because that'll be a third of your grade. God bless you, and may the force be with you.